Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, Pixar has delivered its second film of 2015, The Good Dinosaur. So we'll talk about its relationship to their legacy, the story and look, and whether man's best friend might just be man. Then we'll take another look at a question we've asked ourselves before. When have we just completely reversed our initial impressions? When have we been wrong? And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so don't go away.
In 2013, nine young, undocumented activists walked from Mexico up to border officials in the United States and demanded to be let in and granted asylum. They were wearing their graduation caps and gowns, a uniform that had become the unofficial symbol of the Dreamer movement. Latino USA has their story and much more about the changing American landscape. Listen to Latino USA now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
We've got dinosaurs and the power of changed minds on the show this week, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And finally, back with us after a sojourn to Texas that took her out of our studio for entirely too long, our friend Kat Chow. Kat, what do you do at NPR?
I'm a writer for NPR's Code Switch.
So, Kat, what were you doing in Texas, for those who might be wondering?
Oh, well, I was in Dallas, and I was reporting for KERA, which is a member station there. So, running around doing all of that radio stuff. So, if you're from Dallas, you might have heard me.
First on our schedule this week is The Good Dinosaur. For many years, Pixar has been a one-film-a-year shop. The exception was last year, 2014, which was supposed to be the release year of The Good Dinosaur, but they bumped it up to this year, meaning both it and Inside Out will go down as 2015 Pixar films. This one is about a dinosaur named Arlo who has a pretty typical Disney Pixar experience and is separated from his family and has to find his way home. Voice talent includes young Raymond Ochoa as Arlo, plus Jeffrey Wright and Frances McDormand as his parents, help from folks like Steve Zahn, Anna Paquin, and Sam Elliott, sounding exactly like Sam Elliott.
Mm-hmm.
But before we talk about The Good Dinosaur, I want to talk about Sanjay's Super Team,
yes.
Which is the short that is playing with this film. It's directed by Sanjay Patel, who's worked in the animation department on several Pixar movies and who based it on a true story about himself and his dad. Basically, it follows young Sanjay, whose father really wants him to pay attention to kind of the Hindu prayers that the father is doing. And Sanjay is more interested in superheroes. Glenn, was this up your alley as
a superhero
guy? Oh, my God.
As far away as Lava was from my thing, as much as I found that schmoopy and sort of sentimental.
Oh, I liked that.
We are different people. I loved this. I loved everything about this. I want to talk about this for 15 minutes. Can we just?
Yeah, let's just do that instead.
This is worth the price of admission. It's so smart about the resonances between aspects of mythology and aspects of just loving superheroes.
I loved how it blends those things.
It's so smart. It looks fantastic, and it does everything it does wordlessly. It's a piece of art.
It feels so personal.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you kind of can tell it's personal because the director is Sanjay Patel and it's called Sanjay's Super Team.
At the end, there's a picture of him and his dad.
A picture of him and his dad as if it didn't feel personal enough as it was. I just sat there mouth agape, just delighted throughout that entire thing.
Right. Yeah. And then that moment where the dad kind of toward the end of the short just looks really resigned and then notices that there's a change in his son. That was so poignant.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking about how the director, Sanjay Patel, how he drew from his own life experience. I think he said somewhere that when he was growing up, he wanted his name to be Travis instead of Sanjay.
Oh my gosh.
And that his world was so different than his dad's. Seeing him reflected in a short like that was really nice.
Yeah.
I love the way that Pixar gets to play around with these things. They often feel like experiments, and this felt like just visually different from so many of the movies we've watched. I mean, I really, like you said, Glenn, I wanted to see this blown out into an entire movie, and I certainly want to see Sanjay Patel direct an entire movie. And they often use these as, you know, as training grounds for their directors.
And I think if you follow my writing at all, you know that kind of my catnip thing is blurring boundaries between kinds of culture. And I really, to me, without trivializing anybody's religious experiences, they were able to draw the parallel between gods and superheroes and between idols and idols. And it didn't feel dismissive of the father praying at all. It felt like the spiritual stuff that the father was trying to teach him was basically blending with the stuff that mm-hmm. he was picking up from television and stuff like that, which is really unusual to find places acknowledging that in a really intelligent way.
Yeah.
And then also being able to see that tradition of his dad's religion be carried forward in a new way. I thought that was a really nice touch.
It is great, right? Cartoons, Pixar, Disney, whatever, to see different cultural portrayals. Mm-hmm. And this is a very specific story about this family's specific culture, but it doesn't feel like, look how great we are for doing a story about this particular family. It's specific, but it's still, the reason you're there is that it's such a great story and it doesn't feel dutiful in that way.
That specificity, you know? That uniqueness is why it works. And this topic of specificity might come up again in about 2 minutes.
Yeah. So let's talk about The Good Dinosaur, which is the feature. Glenn, you sound like you did not love this particular feature.
Didn't. I would put this in the lower end, not down with Cars and Planes, but down there. Just because I think what sets Pixar movies apart from DreamWorks, from anything else, is that there is always something hugely specific, something unique, some moment, some character, some idea. Maybe it's the idea behind it, like Monsters, Inc. That's a unique idea.
Yeah.
Doug in Up is a mm-hmm. unique character. When you think of that movie, you think of that thing.
Mm-hmm.
The critic in Ratatouille, that
yeah,
moment
sure.
with the critic. That's what that movie becomes. There is nothing in this movie that really landed with anything like that power. There's a fun image with fireflies, but that's been done before.
Yeah.
There's a really interesting part with a character named Forrest Woodbush, who is actually voiced by the director. He's like a stegosaurus, this guy.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
The guy with all the...
Yeah.
And that character is so weird.
So strange.
And it's like, it feels troubling and
unusual
and unique.
And something's
happening.
And
then you never see that character again.
Yeah. And that's what I want. I wanted something that felt like this film and not like a lot of other animated films.
Yeah.
So that character, the Stegosaurus whatever character, I thought that it was going to reappear again, kind of like an Inside Out. I thought it was going to be like a Bing Bong character.
Yeah.
And I was waiting for that payoff and it just never came.
I'm sorry somebody mentioned Bing Bong.
I know. Sorry. We're all gonna cry
yeah.
now.
Right.
It's okay, take it easy. But there were some really bizarre moments that stuck out. Not in a good way, though. In a way that made me think, like, why would they ever include this in there? I think there's a point where Arlo and his human friend are kind of doing their long journey trek because, of course, this movie needs a long journey trek.
Right, and we should point out that Arlo winds up with essentially a dog.
A feral boy.
But the dog is a person.
Yes.
The pet is a person. And you can see where that was what they thought was the idea, mm-hmm. I think, mm-hmm. is this flip where the main character is the dinosaur, and so his kind of pet sidekick is the boy. Go ahead, Kat.
Yeah, just bizarre. But this moment that really kind of got me was, I don't want to give it too much away, but when they experience something that's kind of psychedelic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, that scene, I didn't understand where it fit in with the movie.
I had a little bit of the opposite reaction of, okay, this is where this movie is going to get weird. Mm-hmm. This is where this movie is going to get a little bit more experimental. I do think the central idea, the conceit, sort of the Monsters, Inc. concept is the, like, what if the asteroid missed?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like, what if dinosaurs and humans are coexisting?
But I don't think it answers that question.
No, it doesn't.
I mean, this could just as easily be, aside from the fact that they create this feral boy, mm-hmm. right, who could not have existed with a dinosaur because of time.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Then, aside from that idea, aside from that itself, this story could take place in the age of the dinosaurs. There's nothing about it that plays with that hypothetical.
It's Milo Notice. It's The Incredible Journey. It's that story.
It's exactly. Also, the word I kept coming back to is pastiche. Mm-hmm. There are so many beats in this movie that are straight out of The Lion King.
Yes.
There's so much, I mean, just...
A lot out of The Lion King.
Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. including, like, shot for shot
right.
in some cases. Obviously, The Land Before Time. Mm-hmm. You can just pick off what in this movie you have seen before. And I was very frustrated because going into it, it excited me so much that because this movie, which you can you can feel that it was a troubled production. Yep. And we can talk a little bit about that in a minute. But it's like they made two movies in 1 year, or they released two movies in 1 year, that aren't franchises, that are freestanding, that are new. And yet this felt so rote. It felt like...
Feels derivative, even though it's not a sequel.
Right. It not only felt rote in terms of... I've seen this before, but even like the lesson, even the moral that we're taking away, you know, so many of these Pixar movies are movies about ideas, you know, ideas, you know, Up is an idea about aging and Wall-E is an idea about, you know, this like was like about facing your fears, which short of like the importance of friendship or the importance of believing in yourself, it's just a more like remedial idea. I didn't hate it. Mm. I just wanted it to be so much more.
Yeah. Here's kind of where I came down on this movie was if the dinosaur were a dog, there's no movie. It's just the dog gets lost, the dog goes home and runs into a couple of creatures along the way. Right. And, you know, the dog has a couple of difficulties and then the dog gets home. Spoiler alert, the dog gets home. It's not a movie unless it's a dinosaur. And yet, aside from the fact that they do this feral boy who is named Spot, and it's a very direct joke about the kid as dog. And there are several parallels there in the way that movies will typically treat boy and dog stories. But aside from that idea, aside from that idea of giving him a pet who's a human, which of course is not really a story about a dinosaur, unless you make this hypothetical, they don't actually have any ideas about dinosaurs, I don't think. I don't think there are any interesting ideas visually or story-wise about dinosaurs in this movie. To me, most Pixar movies come down to a ratio problem. Right? Most Pixar movies, there's X much of it that's magical, and then there's Y much of it that's kind of fine. Mm-hmm. And if the magical part is magical enough, people tend to overlook the other part, which to me is the story of Wall-E. But for me, there are two scenes in this movie that I would consider to be special, that I would consider to be Pixar scenes. They're both between Arlo and Spot, and they both have no dialogue. And they have to do with family, and they have to do with that relationship, and they're very moving. And I thought they were very sweet and touching, and they belonged in a Pixar movie. Everything else is not special. And at times, feels quite lazy, like the employment of a sort of a redneck stereotype for these kind of bad-toothed dinosaurs that I thought was...
The T-Rexes?
No, not the T-Rexes, but the raptors. Those kind of gross ones that... And it, to me, it's... I mean, they actually call each other Bubba and Lurline. And I was like, come on. Like, do the work. Do you know what I mean? And I didn't feel like it had the stuff of inside. I don't know, Kat. Am I being too mean to this movie?
No. I mean, throughout the whole movie, whenever Arlo spoke and Spot grunted, I kept thinking, what if this movie was like Wall-E and there was no dialogue?
And I thought that too, because I started thinking about the pieces of Pixar movies that I have loved the most, right? The beginning of Up, the beginning of Wall-E.
Right.
I mean, I wonder whether Pixar is really should be making silent movies, you know what I mean? Like whether they should be making dialogue-less movies.
And I think it would have helped me care a little bit more about Arlo the dinosaur. I don't know, just because watching this cartoon dinosaur, I just saw it going through the very Pixar-ish motions, like what we were talking about before, the losing of the family member, the embarking on a long journey. And I just thought, okay, so what? This isn't going to deviate at all. It's just, I already know what the outcome is going to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We're kind of up against a couple of the things that are interesting about this movie kind of pulling back from the movie itself. One is I think this is a visually spectacular movie.
Yes.
I think the character design on the dinosaurs is kind of the least interesting thing.
Yep.
But the incredible movement of water.
Yeah. That's exactly it. It's taken years for us to be able to render water with any kind of realism like
it's,
this.
It's an uncanny valley.
We're there.
In animation. And they achieve
it. Looks
it.
Real. Yeah.
They achieve it in this movie to the point where it almost at times looks like a fusion of animation and live action.
Yeah, totally.
And that is a feat that I don't think, you know, I don't think we should fail to point out how visually stunning this movie is in spots. And there are a couple of very nice shots in this movie. There's a scene where you're watching the pterosaurs circling from above and they're piercing the clouds and it's like seeing shark fins upside down. It's a really neat shot. There's anything where water is moving is remarkable. But when you talk about this could have been a silent film, first of all, like, yeah, visually they could make it. how troubled a production this apparently was does come into play. And one of the things that they did in the like 18 months between when this movie was supposed to come out and now is they apparently like redid all of the voices.
Yeah.
Frances McDormand was a voice in the original version, but this originally was supposed to star Neil Patrick Harris. The dad was supposed to be voiced by John Lithgow instead of Jeffrey Wright, who does this very like gruff kind of cowboy dad. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's John Lithgow, Bill Hader, Judy Greer. That's a very different set of voices than you have in this movie.
They originally conceived Arlo to be older, to be almost an adult, and they aged him down to 11, recast the entire thing, rewrote the, reimagined the entire film, took out this whole notion of Amish farmers, as the dinosaurs as Amish farmers, and went a different direction.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I will say that the pterosaurs are legitimately scary, such
they
that they chased at least one Muppet out of the theater, who was not having it, but other than that,
whenever this movie gets to the point where it's trying to kind of pull those levers, you just feel those levers pulling.
Yeah.
The fact that there is such a literal application of the idea that Arlo wants to make his mark is so... Really?
Yeah.
And I was thinking about this because since John Lasseter went over from, had been at Disney, went over and ran Pixar before Disney acquired it. And then when Disney acquired it, came back and kind of became the head of Walt Disney and Pixar and everything. And since kind of those have all been kind of one thing under one umbrella, but still making separate films, there have been a bunch of Disney movies that I have felt were nicely Pixar-inflected.
Yeah.
Wreck-It Ralph and I think Frozen. I would argue Frozen. Tangled a little bit. Certainly Big Hero 6.
Oh, yeah.
Movies that have felt Pixar-inflected to me. This is the first Pixar movie that feels Disney-inflected in the way that Disney was making movies prior to that combination of studios. This is one where I feel like the kind of a little more... basic, because Disney has always been able to make some very pretty movies, but I always felt like Pixar was bringing a level of emotional sophistication that often was not present in those movies. This again feels to me like that emotional sophistication has drained out of it, and what you have is mostly like go on a journey, get chased by a big dog.
Generic.
You know what I mean?
The lack
of emotionalness is taking backseat to everything else.
Yeah.
It felt very committee-driven. And I think that's part of what happens when you have to take a partially finished movie and try to remake it in different ways. You're going to have a clash between the two. The director of this movie is a guy named Peter Son. And he, among other things, he made the short film, I can't remember which movie it was before, but it was Partly Cloudy with the Storks. Delivering like little cloud babies.
Which is such an adorable little tag.
And Russell was based off of him from Up.
And it is so
nice.
That short is so funny.
Yeah.
And it has such imagination and warmth, but also just this undercurrent of like violence.
Yeah.
That is a terrific little short film.
Yeah.
You know that the director who, you know, who voiced that weird, wonderful character, you get a sense because he was brought in partway through, too. They also changed directors.
Right.
And you kind of just wonder how good this thing could have been with consistent visionary behind
it. But the thing is, there's a book that I have been kind of gradually, it's an audiobook, and I've been gradually listening to it over literally like a year, a little bit at a time, by Ed Catmull, who's one of the guys who works at, he's one of the executives at Pixar and has been there for a long time. And one of the things they talk about is, look, they have always had a committee process.
Right.
They have always had a very, they have what they call the brain trust,
sure,
which is this, you know, table full of people, originally almost exclusively dudes, who would look at everything and work together and call people out on kind of in a productive way about this isn't working. And there are a lot of stories about how these movies have come to be through working with that committee. They seem to have a committee process that usually does get them to a thing that still feels specific and more vision driven. This wound up feeling more like a committee project in the way that people don't love, in that it lacks that specificity and vision. Well, I'll be interested to see how many of you out there saw The Good Dinosaur, whether you intend to see it. If you have kids, your kids will eventually see it. Let's be serious. But
Sanjay, super team.
Sanjay Super Team, seriously, go out and see it if just to see Sanjay Super Team. If you pay for the movie, you watch the short and then you leave, I'm not going to be mad at you. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on Twitter at PCHH or, you know, just find us at NPR.org and let us know what you think. When we come back, we're going to talk about one of our favorite topics, when we were wrong, times that we got something totally wrong and ultimately changed our opinion. So don't go away.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Makespace. For people who dream about having a bigger closet and never want to visit a storage unit again, Makespace is like having an infinite closet. Here's how it works. Makespace picks up your stuff for free. They take it to storage for you, and they bring it back whenever you want. And now Makespace is giving all listeners $50 of free storage. Just schedule a pickup at makespace.com or download the Makespace app and enter promo code POP.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Now, before the break, we talked about The Good Dinosaur, which we found to be, in some cases, wrong. And this is where we talk about how we are, in some cases, wrong. When you are in the business of giving your opinion, as often as some of us are, it is inevitable that every now and then, or perhaps more often than that, you find yourself saying, either. Now, I'm going to talk about my taxonomy of wrongness. But Thompson, do you want to talk about being wrong?
We're in the business of having opinions. And I find that the more shrill my opinion, the more likely I am to like jump on Twitter and like pop off, the more likely I am to have to figure out how I'm going to walk back the kind of wrongheaded thing that I wound up saying. And of course, we're in the business of like, we saw The Good Dinosaur. We kind of immediately pop into the studio. Maybe remember when we saw Frozen?
It's on my list.
Okay. Well, yeah, we can get to that. Of coming away, like not having absorbed the way a movie or an album or a book like hits other people or the way that it hits us as we kind of churn on it for a few days. And the examples that I kind of kept coming back to were more in the realm of music. There's a band a few years ago that came out with a record called An Awesome Wave. The band is called Alt-J. And the singer is a guy named Joe Newman who sings in this very odd kind of pinched, slightly alien voice. And Bob Boylan and Robin Hilton from All Songs Considered like lost their minds over this record and how great this record is. And Bob just could not stop talking about it. It was his number one album of the year. It won the Mercury Prize. And I just sat there just seething. And I remember like jumping to Twitter. And this is how you know I'm wrong. Is if I jump to Twitter to scream about it. Let's actually hear a little bit of the song Fitz Pleasure.
Hear your who flies off.
So that voice, I was like, is that an Adam Sandler voice on Saturday Night Live? Or is that Latka Gravis on Taxi? There's almost like a silliness to that voice. Mm-hmm. It drove me nuts. And I missed all these beautiful, weird, kind of strangely sexy songs on that record. And Alt-J put out another record a couple years later that was in my top 10 list, in part because they dialed down the shrillness and dialed up the kind of atmospheric quality. But I was on Twitter making fun of that guy's voice for like 2 hours. And look back on that, like, how do I explain how I put this next record on my top 10 list?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I feel like this means, you know what this means? It means I'm going to ultimately love this new Adele record. Which I went on Twitter and right away, like, oh, this is the glummest glumminess that ever glummed. But, like, that is another record that I had a visceral, like, oh, I'm so disappointed. But over time, I know that different songs on that record are going to grab me.
How long do you think that's going to take, that turnaround?
My brain works pretty slowly. So give it a few months.
All right, Kat Chow, how about wrongness?
Oh, man. Okay, so in 2009, this movie called The Timer came out. It's a rom-com. It stars Emma Caulfield, and it's kind of about these people who have timers implanted into their arms, and the timers count down to the exact instance when they meet their soulmate.
That's right.
Oh, right. Okay. Back in 2009, when I first watched this movie, I thought, you know, this is an okay rom-com. It kind of follows the formula where you have the main character who is going about her life searching for love, and she has a sister or a stepsister who is equally lonely and without a partner, and they're portrayed as really wanting to find their soulmate. The main character, her timer is maxed out, meaning she has no idea when her soulmate is going to show up. As
like,
a rom-com.
Not, the clock's not moving.
Right, it's not moving, and so she's so frustrated.
Been there.
Yeah, we've all been. Okay, so at the time, I think I thought, you know, this is, you know, a harmless rom-com, and it would be the type of thing that I'd recommend to a friend to watch on Netflix kind of for a mindless night. And
a mindless night.
A mindless night. When
that's,
you
the name,
wanna...
that's the name of my that's the name of my album of love songs.
That's my life. So I rewatched it when I was in Dallas with a friend, and we were so fixated on the idea of how this movie was basically circling around the concept of whether or not soulmates exist. I mean, the movie basically says, yes, there is that true love, of course.
Sure.
But the point of contention was, is the idea of having the one, is that parameter, is that helpful toward the actual movie? Like, does the movie support a life where you only have one person in your life?
Oh, I see.
Or is it actually arguing against waiting around for that one person?
I see.
And then somehow, like, us talking about that became so fraught and personal, and I was like, how did this conversation emerge from the timer?
And you really
and it was
so Kat's written on Twitter, like,
loving,
fighting really hard over the timer, and everybody else is like, what's the timer?
Yeah. And I'm like, go watch on Netflix so we can fight about it too.
I was gonna say, like, I want that to be a really interesting movie, because I want to have that fight too,
right? Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like,
I mean,
there's soulmates and then there's putting in the work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought it could have the ability to be kind of like The Circle, the David Eggers novel, where it's really futuristic and whatnot.
Right.
But no, I don't know.
So did it change your mind about the movie?
It made me think about it more.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I don't know if it changed my mind about it.
That's very interesting. I've had that experience, I think, of like watching something and being like, is this more fraught than I originally thought it was?
Why is this messing me up?
Yeah. 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 Definitely. But that's very interesting, Kat. How about you, Glenn? What about you?
So I've been wrong on the show. I was wrong about Frozen. We talked about that. I was wrong about Winter Soldier. I was distracted by the last bit, the very last action movie bit where we see the same thing happen three times. Mm-hmm. I was so soured on that it soured me on the entire film. But the actual film holds up.
I defended that movie a little bit, didn't I?
Yeah,
you did.
Yeah,
you did.
Like,
I staunchly defended that movie
a little bit. I was wrong. What this reminded me of is that I spent much of the 90s in the company of straight, white, male writers of fiction. And as experiences go...
You realized that was a bad idea.
Yeah, I don't recommend it. You know, individually, they can be charming. I count one of them among my best friends. Mm-hmm. You get them in groups, and you herd them together, and they form a pack. They form a pack of what I call fiction bros. And if it's the 90s, they are filled with resentment against, like, the tidy, you know, airless New Yorker short story. You know, they hate the Alice Munros of the world. Mm-hmm. And they overvalue writers like Bukowski and William T. Vollman is a nonfiction writer, and Kerouac, and especially the collection of short stories called Jesus's Son by Dennis Johnson. Do you know this book?
Mm-mm.
Okay, it's a collection of different short stories, but they're linked because it's ostensibly the same narrator seen at different points of his life. And they value this book, and they keep pressing it into your hand because it's about, you know, junkies and alcoholics. It's about real things, man. It's not like this stuff in The New Yorker. Could never get published in The New Yorker. Dennis Johnson's been in The New Yorker many times.
Mm-hmm.
It's so real. That's what I actually heard some of them say to each other. Whenever this book, the topic of this book would come up, it's so real, man. It's a dude from Yale saying, yeah, it's so real, this book, which is set among lowlifes and detox centers and criminals and things like this. And
because you can legitimately think that, but you're talking about something from a From a far remove.
They didn't idealize. They had a very different view of this world and this life. And I read it, and I judged the audience for the book. That made me judge the characters in the book. That made me judge the book itself.
I see.
And the author of the book. And I realized, after I revisited it, I hated it when I read it, because it just felt so... The thing I got from it is that somehow... These books about junkies and prostitutes and alcoholics, and about junkie alcoholic prostitutes, are there's something ennobling and more true in that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of Bukowski feeling you get, the Dennis Johnson feeling. And I realized I was making that up. The book doesn't have that, because I revisited it recently, and I let myself get distracted by the fact that I didn't recognize myself in the work. Mm. And that is the most selfish reaction you can have to a piece of art. You don't see yourself, therefore it has nothing to say to you. When in fact, the point of fiction is to get you out of your own damn head and into somebody else's and look around and experience it. And I realized reading it second, I still don't, you know, I'm not supposed to like the characters. They're horrible people. But I realized that as a feat of narrative construction, this thing is priceless. All these stories take place at different parts in the guy's life, right? And that causes, and it's a very discursive, all these stories are very discursive. There's one story called Two Men, and he never gets to describing the second man because he is a junkie and his mind wanders. And so you get this cubist approach to this guy's life that isn't hopeless and pretentiously about suffering. It's human. And there's some feats of just narrative compression. Things happen in these sentences that, like, an entire life summed up in a sentence. It's great. Mm-hmm. I needed time away from the place where I was a lot of dude bros talking about fiction, to appreciate it in the way that I do now.
Yeah.
There's actually a common thread, I think, between what you're saying and what I was saying about Alt-J, which is you really run the risk of being wrong when your reaction to something is that the wrong people like it.
Exactly.
Whether it's Lit Bros in your case or Bob Boylan in mine.
Well, and it's
they like it for the wrong reasons.
It has to do with confusing the thing itself with the social phenomenon around the thing.
It's not really about representation so much. Maybe it's about I see in the thing what I fear most about myself. Maybe that's what I saw. Mm-hmm. Right? Because this book is really, the fiction bros really love fiction that's about white dudes not living up to the expectations that society puts on us, right?
Oh, tears.
It's so hard. Nobody understands how hard it is being a white dude. And how we
But there
have
are
to
many great so books gonna, about that. So there are gonna, many great books about the struggles of white dudes. That's
sure.
The thing.
So, but like, and so we're going to compensate, we're going to destroy ourselves, man. Because
right,
we
no,
destroy
no.
ourselves. You can't destroy us like that. And that is my least favorite thing in the universe is that thing.
I understand. Two things. First of all, I've talked many times about TV shows that I've been wrong about, some of which I think the last time we did a similar topic to this, I talked about Friday Night Lights. That's a well-known story. In retrospect, when I look at that season now, I think of it as essentially perfect, that first season. But the pilot standing alone was a hard sit for me because of this kind of sprawling nature of the characters and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But there are other ones too, right? The Mindy Project was like this for me. When I first watched the pilot, I thought, she's too much of a jerk. She actually seems to be a bad doctor. I don't want to watch this. She seems like an actual terrible person, which is not the way I wanted to go. They also were drawing Danny, the character, kind of her primary love interest, as too mean of a jerk also.
Yeah.
And I was turned off by the whole thing. You know, my argument would be, as the show went on, they kind of balanced those things out. I suspect their argument to a degree would be maybe some of that happened, but also it's a matter of you as the viewer settling into these people and learning a little bit more about them having different aspects to their personalities. So there are a bunch of shows that are like that. And we've talked before about like Parks and Rec and The American Office and stuff like that. But when I mentioned a taxonomy of wrongness, there's a difference between I was wrong, I don't think I would stand by that assessment now. Right, which is kind of my Friday Night Lights thing. The Friday Night Lights thing I now actually think of as like it was only because it was out of the context of the entire season that pilot didn't really work for me. I now do not look back at it and say, bad pilot. Whereas I am the rare critic defender of The Big Bang Theory, as some people know. Mm-hmm. Enjoy it very much, find it lots of fun, silly fun. Pilot is terrible. Mm-hmm. And I said at the time, terrible. I would have sworn I would never watch that show. So are you wrong when that happens, or are you predicting imperfectly based on the information that you have? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So those are kind of different ways of being wrong.
You being right, the universe being wrong.
Well, exactly.
That's the way I think of it.
But then the other thing that I wanted to mention that I thought might be relevant to people who listen to the show is that I asked myself whether there's anything we've ever done on the show that I regret, where I felt like it was wrong. And I thought, I don't think I regret anything that I've said on the show or done on the show in terms of like, this was a wrong opinion, right? There's things that I look back and say, like, I wish I hadn't said that way. It sounded stupid or not as sensitive as I would have liked or whatever. But what I do
look back on. There's only one segment we've ever done on the show that if I had it to do over again, I wouldn't do. And that's the one that we did about the casting of Star Wars, because it was very early.
Yeah.
And they had just put out the first cast photo.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think you can argue they should never have put that photo out. It was really early in the casting process. They hadn't cast substantial roles for women. It looked kind of like, other than Boyega from Attack the Block, which we knew about, it looked like it was this gigantic sea of white dudes and Carrie Fisher, I guess.
Yep.
And so we did the segment because it was in the news and we talked about it and it seemed worth talking about. And I think all the issues in it were worth talking about. But I would have waited substantially longer. It was kind of one of those learn on the job things where I think it's, I mean, I think I understand why it made sense to me to do it. But in retrospect, I say to myself, I wouldn't do it that way. I would do it later. And so now when we do things that are in the news, I think that I bring that experience to it. You know what I mean?
I think that's also a product of trying to reflect the news. And so much of news reporting, especially like breaking news reporting, as part of a news organization, we're constantly reflecting as like major shocking news stories are unfolding. There is this thing where you have to take a step back and be like, okay, half of what we're hearing is completely wrong.
I think that's what that, fortunately, I don't think it did a ton of harm. I think it was, some of it was conversation. I think some of it was conversation that probably just, we would have come out differently. I think the principles behind it, I would stand by.
Right.
But the decision to have that conversation then based on the information that we had, as opposed to, for example, the information that we have now, where it's more about they don't have action figures of the woman. You know what I mean? Like that's more where you are as opposed to they didn't seem to have any. So I would have done it later so that the information that it was based on would have been different.
Yeah, my my reaction to Star Wars now would just be complete and utter exhaustion.
Well, that's the other thing is like, would we really be even doing it now? Because it might be. Anyway.
Right.
So that's me wrong about a bunch of different things. And and when we come back, we're going to talk about our favorite thing this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? So come right back.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message come from NatureBox.com. At NatureBox, they understand that your life is busy and there's not always time to get to the store. NatureBox makes it easy to start snacking smarter. Choose from over 100 tasty options like Sriracha Roasted Cashews and French Toast Granola. Or fill out your snack profile and get personalized recommendations delivered right to your door. Spend more time doing what you love and less time trying to find parking. Visit naturebox.com/pop and get 50% off your first box now.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
A couple things. While prepping for the discussion of The Good Dinosaur, I went down a little reading about Pixar rabbit hole and found a wonderful piece that our pal Noel Murray posted in Vulture, in which he ranked the 30 Pixar short films from worst to best. You'll be glad to know, Glenn, that Lava did not fare very well.
No, good.
I mean, Noel, I mean, he's our pal. I'm in the tank for him. We've said this a million times. There's just a bunch of wonderful insight about those films, and I realized how few of them I've actually seen.
Well, a lot of them are on like Blu-rays and DVDs and stuff like that.
And a bunch of them I actually have because I'll just I would acquire the DVDs. I have kids, so you know, you acquire the DVDs of these Pixar movies. But if I didn't see them in the theater, chances are I never went and sought out the short film on the DVD. So I've got a bunch of really great short films to watch if Noel's opinion is any indication, and it so often is. The other thing for me, this is such a minor pleasure, but the fourth season of MasterChef Junior.
Oh yeah.
Has been airing, and it's a minor pleasure. The Gordon Ramsay Fox reality show with kids. It is a fun kind of sweet show. You get a lot of critiques like listing a bunch of the problems with the kids' dish and then saying, on the other hand, great job. Mm-hmm. Which, because we can't possibly just pummel these kids.
Uh-huh.
So it's a very sweet natured show. I have tried watching The Great British Baking Show, which we've talked about. You have praised in great, with great fanfare, Linda.
Uh-huh.
It's a little too polite for me. It's a little too slow for me. It's a little too quaint for me.
You're just a monster.
And I felt terrible because I know that the praise for that show is universal. And yet, I just need a little more noise. in my cooking show. I am very happy to be watching MasterChef Junior. That is, of course, a really fun show to watch with your kids. Mm-hmm. So the fourth season of MasterChef Junior.
Nice. Gotcha. Well done, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, sir?
Two things. I spent much of last week off the grid, or at least as far off the grid as I get.
Yeah, you did.
In a little cabin we bought. So I spent the week, hacking apart old television antennas, rusty television antennas, and hauling stuff to the dump.
Oh, it's a great feeling. It's the best.
And breaking up clods of dirt. Why am I pussyfooting around the word rugged? I spent the word doing rugged things, and we didn't have internet, so I had to talk to my husband and read books. Imagine that. I picked up a book at a used bookstore called The Brain Dead Megaphone, which is a collection of essays by George Saunders. I know him as a fiction writer.
Sure.
I've read his essays here and there, all over the place. This all collects them. It's a 2007 book. I didn't realize it when I picked it up, but the title essay is the least strong because it is about the degradation of mass media in the wake of 9/11 and the O.J. Simpson trial.
Sure.
And there's a lot of old man yells at cloud in to it. And, you know, at one point he says, "Welcome to America in 2003. And I was like, dude, you have no idea what's coming.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Prepare yourself. Mm-hmm. And there's another one where he basically looks, these are lyrics to music. And like, it's like, you're going a little too Andy Rooney.
Is it Ram a Lama Ding Dong?
Yeah, it's similar. But whenever it's one of his pieces of travel writing, he does this great piece about Dubai, especially when he kind of dissects his influences. Great piece about Vonnegut, great piece about the book Johnny Tremaine, and especially trenchant, insightful, funny piece about my favorite short story in the world, Donald Barthelme's The School. He talks about how that story works, how it builds, how it plays with the reader's expectations, how it is constructed. You can just tell what a great teacher he is just from that essay. So that is The Brain Dead Megaphone, a great little book of Saunders pieces. You can skip a couple. The second thing is the Marvel series on Netflix, Jessica Jones.
Nice.
Now, I went into this thing. Perhaps we'll talk about it at some point. But in the meantime, this belongs squarely in the grim and gritty superhero storytelling mode. It's not my favorite, only because I grew up in a time when that was all there was.
Right.
We became enamored of the grim and gritty thing for much of my teenage years. Poochification, exactly. We have been doing noir pastiche in superhero storytelling for so long that for it to interest me, there has to be something new. And the other thing is that I think I'm on safe ground here when I say that in male superhero narratives, the hero gets to have the conventional hero's journey, right? The, call to adventure, the refusal of the call. It seems to me that in a distressingly high percentage of narratives, superhero narratives about women, the triggering action, the call to adventure, is some form of abuse or some violation. And you know what? Survivorship stories can be inspiring. They can be thrilling. You know, revenge stories can be great.
Right.
You know, the Greeks knew that. They wrote about revenge all the time.
Right.
When that is the default, simply because that's the sex of your character, that says something very ugly about us as a society. So I went into this thing with both arms crossed. If this show was simply about it, and the first episode left me cold, by the way, because it was hitting all these abuse story beats in a very TV way, very surfacey, very conventional. I'd seen it before. The show is really about, as you go into the season, the show is really about that abuse and what happens after. And it's not being used exploitatively. It is not simply a triggering action. That's backstory. It is about survival and the character of Kilgrave, played by David Tennant, who is the villain, the manipulator, the emotional, mental manipulator. He's working on a metaphorical level so cleanly, so well. And it's David Tennant being David Tennant. He's fantastic. And it's a really terrifying villain, which is something I didn't necessarily expect to see in this story. And it's really doubling down on its subject matter, not shying away from it, not using it surfacely, and really has something to say in a surprising way. So I do recommend Jessica Jones on Netflix.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Glenn. I got like 10 minutes into Jessica Jones. And there's a scene where she's spying into an apartment building and she sees a fat lady on a treadmill who then gets off the treadmill and eats a burger like in her living room.
Yeah.
And Jessica Jones says, 2 minutes on the treadmill, 20 minutes with the burger. And I sat there and I thought, okay, because when I mentioned this on Twitter, there are a bunch of people who said, well, it's just to tell you how mean she is. And I said, but it's also has a cartoonish portrayal of lady in the window without whom there's no joke. And I was reassured. I didn't put it down forever, but it's why I haven't watched it yet, is the time that I made to sit down and watch it, I immediately was like, I don't feel strong enough for this today.
That is perfectly valid. It has both feet in the grim and gritty. It just gets darker and darker.
But that's not grim and gritty. That's just lazy to me.
That's exactly
and that's what made me angry about it. It's like when you have talked sometimes about comedians who do gay jokes and you say, like, it's not so much the offense. It's like the, what do you do that for? It's so dumb.
Yeah,
like,
it's not even necessary.
And that was kind of my, and everybody said to me, it's not like that throughout. It doesn't necessarily make that particular kind of lazy joke throughout. So I will get to it. I'm just explaining, like, that is my initial, that was my initial non-encounter with Jessica Jones. I'm sure I'll get used to it. I'll get used to it. Thank you very much, Glenn. Kat Chow, what is making you happy this week?
So what's making me happy is Adrian Tomina's graphic novel, Killing and Dying. I first became familiar with his work kind of late in the game, earlier this year. He did this comic about the character Long Duk Dong from 16 Candles a long, long time ago. But his new book, Killing and Dying, it's a collection of, I would describe it as kind of short stories that are all so poignant, and they're all told from really very different points of views. So one is about a mother kind of telling a story about her life to her son or her daughter, her child. There's something about the perspective that he brings to each story that is so different than the one before. Like another one is about a relationship where it just really develops in a kind of eerie way. And so it just takes you through so many different parts of life, and I think it's really worth checking out.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And I wrote about it for the Book Concierge, so it'll be coming out at the end of this year.
Thank you very much, Kat Chow. Very interesting stuff, as always. Thank you. Before the holiday, and the reason I am giving this explanation is that this is a little farther in the past than I would normally do my happy because we were on vacation, so I didn't get to talk about it last week. Stephen and I both were at the live taping here in D.C. of Bullseye, which is Jesse Thorne's show. It taped here as we taped this a week ago. And that night, the first guest was, well, there was Phoebe Robinson, who's a comedian who is very funny. Ray Suarez, who's on Al Jazeera America and also has a history in other parts of public radio, including here. And then Dan Deacon. And I am not notoriously an electronic music person, it is safe to say. I was also emphatically not in a dancing sort of mood when I went to this event. If you had asked me in advance, is there any possibility that you are going to dance at this event? I would have said, there is not a snowball's chance in anywhere in the deserts of Arizona that I'm going to dance in the next 2 hours.
Yep.
Never. Not a chance. First of all, the other parts of the show, super excellent.
Yep.
Phoebe Robinson, very funny.
And I believe that's not airing until like January.
Very possible. So the rest of you can just wait. Ray Suarez, really funny, charming, super insightful.
It's so weird being on the same stage as all these like dignity havers.
Exactly. And Stephen and I popped up there and gave a couple of recommendations of things. But mostly I enjoyed attending it, not so much being on it. And then there was the Dan Deacon dance party, which, if you know anything about Dan Deacon, it's this, like, I don't even know how to describe it. It's this kind of participatory, involuntary, and then you're just doing it. It's really, really mystifying, but it was really fun. And there's a way in which he says that no cowards are allowed, that all of a sudden you just are like, okay. And then you're just not one, because you can't be, because that's not one of the choices. I don't know.
And I was sitting there thinking about how to be a coward in that situation.
Yeah,
if you want to see this exact thing happen, he did do a Tiny Desk concert, which has that crazy participatory dance party in it. He's also, it just helps so much that he is so funny.
He's absolutely delightful. It was wonderful. It was the epitome of making me happy this week and every week. And I should also throw in, super thank you to everybody who listened to the Trevor Noah thing that went up last week as our show. Really fun and capped off a month in which we had conversations with Shonda Rhimes and J.K. Rowling and our live show with Fred Armisen. So we're branching out, bringing you all kinds of interesting folks. So all kinds of stuff making me happy this week. So that is what's making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen and Glenn at G.H. Weldon. You can follow Kat at Kat Chow. That's K-A-T-C-H-O-W. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are having a dance party to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
In 2013, 9 young, undocumented activists walked from Mexico up to border officials in the United States and demanded to be let in and granted asylum. They were wearing their graduation caps and gowns, a uniform that had become the unofficial symbol of the Dreamer movement. Latino USA has their story and much more about the changing American landscape. Listen to Latino USA now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.